We are living in an American culture that has shifted from tolerant to cancel culture, from supportive to disruptive, from decent to rude, from optimistic to cynical, and from relatively safe to increasingly violent. Many are willing to exchange their liberty for a form of socialism. Through this podcast, we will chart a course to get America back on track.
Hi, I am Allie Farah, daughter of Barry Farah. My dad's a best-selling author, CEO across six industries, and former candidate for governor of Colorado. He is also a private pilot, adventurer, and engaging life coach. I should know. Through Culture Shift, my dad will systematically deliver a fresh and compelling path that will help you create your own American dream.
Hey, welcome back to the Barry Farah Show, Culture Shift. Today we're going to talk about economic freedom and the Bible's support of it in light of a recent development related to short selling. First, let's look at the short sale. Hedge funds sell short on stock for a whole number of reasons. They're very sophisticated investors. They are very aware of the risks. Because of the free market, they just got beat at their own game. Here's what just happened. So GameStop is based in Dallas suburb of Texas called Grapevine. It's a video game retailer. And before COVID, it operated 5,509 retail stores throughout United States, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand. But with retail seemingly on the way out forever, hedge funds aggressively shorted the stock. It had a 52-week low of $2.57. Yet, recently, millions of small investors have teamed up through Wall Street Bets and Reddit to bid the stock price up. And boy, was that successful. Its recent closing high was $483. Their goal was to force the short sellers to buy the stock at higher prices, incurring losses and pushing the price even higher. So any of the Wall Street players who didn't manage to close their GameStop short positions in time could theoretically have to pay crazy amounts of money to the Wall Street Bets small investors. That's called a short squeeze, squeezing the guys who sold short. So what is selling short? A short sale is a transaction in which the seller does not actually own the stock that's being sold, but borrows it from a broker dealer. So the seller then has the obligation to buy back the stock at some point in the future. Short sales are always a margin transaction. You're putting up just a portion of your own cash and you're getting a loan for the rest of the deal. The lender is the broker dealer. He's a broker dealer. So this arrangement is just fraught with risk. A short sale has an enormous amount of risk. In fact, it's considered to be unlimited. So you might say, why is it so unlimited? Well, that's because before the borrowed shares must be returned, the investor's betting that the price will continue to go down and they can purchase them at a lower cost. The risk of loss on a short sale is theoretically completely unlimited since the price of an asset can climb to infinity. So when you invest in a stock the old-fashioned way, you just buy it and you're hoping it's actually going to go up in value, your risk is significant, but it's limited to 100% of the investment. If you buy $10,000 of ABC Company and the stock price goes to zero, you can only lose that $10,000 and no more if you buy what they call long, the normal way people buy stock that most people think about. But if you want to short those same 1,000 shares of that ABC Company that are trading at, let's say, $10 a share, or that's your short price, then you'll owe 1,000 shares of that ABC Company stock at some point in the future. You see why it's precarious? If the stock's price drops, you win. I mean, if it drops to zero, you don't even owe the lender anything, and you would make a nice profit of $10,000. But what if the price kept climbing to, let's say, $500 a share? You bought it at, you sold short at 10, you're hoping it goes to zero, but it goes the other direction. And it keeps on going. And you kept thinking it would go back down, so you held on to it. But you still have to deliver those 1,000 shares. You were wrong. It went up to $500. How are you going to get out of this bind? So you've got to deliver those shares somehow. And the only way is to buy them. So you buy those shares that cost you $10 a share for $500 a share. And when you deliver those 1,000 shares to the broker-dealer, which cost you $500,000, you've got a whopping $490,000 loss. I mean, that's a 4,900% loss. And in theory, The price can keep climbing even beyond that and make your potential loss limitless. So let's just step back and look at what just happened. If you multiply that particular scenario by several million shares, that's pretty close to what the hedge funds selling short in GameStop are faced with right now. That's why any broker-dealer worth his salt will make sure the short seller investor is aware of the exorbitant loss potential. I mean, you're borrowing stock, selling it, and hoping it'll go down so you can buy it again. Are you sure you want to do this? And the broker-dealers are always very aware of the risks for themselves. But these brokers, like Robinhood, Interactive Brokers, and Webull, stopped allowing for trading, which, according to the investors, purposefully, willfully, and knowingly deprived retail investors of the ability to invest in the open market. The ban on purchases is particularly effective at relieving the squeeze. So when the retail investors are only allowed to sell, which is kind of against the rules, and I'm thinking against the law, only the institutional investors are allowed to buy. If the establishment players hold back on the purchases, then the market will gradually flood with sale offers, pushing the price down, and that would prompt even more sales. But that's not the scenario right now. That assumes that the retail investors are willing to sell. This Reddit forum of users, they've urged each other not to sell until the squeeze gets drastic and the price is astronomical. What's their end game? They want to force a situation in which the institutional investors don't have enough GameStop stock among themselves to return all the stock they borrowed and shorted. The big institutional hedge funds like Melvin Capital are forced to sell assets or dip into cash reserves to cover their short positions. That adds even more fuel to the fire. I mean, there was a flash sell-off a couple days ago at the very same time all this was going on. Did the big guys sell positions in stocks like Apple and Microsoft to cover their butts? Why did Robinhood stop processing buy orders on GameStop stock? Global investment powerhouse Citadel happens to own Robinhood, and they're an institutional short seller. They have direct ties to Melvin Capital, and who knows what's going on there, but it looks like had a significant short interest in GameStop directly. So it'll be interesting to see how all this pans out at this moment in time. I don't know. But regardless, the story is fascinating. I mean, normally when Wall Street loses, they just change the rules. But in this instance, the free market may have unleashed a whole new area for the little guy. It's the most effective way to level the playing field, free and open markets. And we're going to get to more on that in a minute. Now what we're going to do is just take a quick look at what the Bible has to say about you and your ability to create and develop. Now, what's interesting is Jesus talked about economics and money more than he did heaven and hell combined. Jesus talked about money more than anything else except the kingdom of God. 11 of the 39 parables talk about economics and money. One out of every 7 verses in the Gospel of Luke talk about economics and money. Life issues, marriage issues, family issues are explicit, but money is actually covered more than those. That's probably because the exchange of goods and labor and money for services and products and other goods and labor really does touch everyone. So what's the Bible cover? It covers a business owner's obligations. It even covers how the business owner should handle success when he gets there. It covers debt management, budgeting, how to build up over time. The Bible covers giving, investing, lending, planning, saving, stewardship. Have you ever wondered why? Well, the bottom line is that God's for you. He actually wants you to do well. Jeremiah 29:11 says, "For I know the plans and thoughts that I think towards you," says the Lord. Plans and thoughts of peace, welfare, good, improvement, and not of evil, to give you a positive outcome, a future, and a hope. He really is for you. He is on your side. Let's go back to the very beginning. God created man and woman in his image, two distinct, beautiful creations, but they were the capstone of his creation. So first he creates the universe, he creates the atmosphere and the water cycle, he creates dry land, plant life and the seasons, and then more advanced forms of plants. And then he creates fish and birds, and he creates land animals and dinosaurs. They die off after further preparing the Earth for sophisticated life. Then the Neanderthal types were created to prepare Earth for humans. They die off. So then you get the crowning creation. Male and female are made in his likeness, in his image. That's why you possess an eternal soul. That's why you have a consciousness of your own existence. That's why you can train a dog. It doesn't really go the other way around. I mean, some of you might think your dog trains you, but you know what I mean. You train the dog. And you can choose to live by an intentional moral code. It's also why you can create things, not from absolutely nothing, but from what he has already created. You can add value. You can build a building or a hotel or design a gorgeous resort or prepare a beautiful 7-course meal or invent comfortable clothing or furniture, craftsmanship or whatever. It's also why you can volitionally worship God. So there they are, male and female, standing there. What is the first thing God does with to this creation, this male and female? He blesses them. God blessed them, and God said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and rule over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the sky and over every living thing that moves on the earth." Genesis 1:28. God made us with the intent of it being our responsibility to add value to the earth. And this work thing was part of our destiny before the fall. I mean, God called his creation on earth good. There's a word for good and there's a word for perfect, which would not only mean that it's done well, but that there's no room for any improvement upon it. But all of the creation events, God saw it and said it's good. He didn't say it was completely perfect, that there wouldn't be any ability to add to it, but there was room for improvement. And that's why Adam, in the beginning, before the fall, cultivates, plants, and he names all the animals. Those are value-added propositions. So what's it mean to subdue? To tame it. This is the earth before the fall. To train it, to figure it out, to investigate, to understand, use it, enjoy it, develop it into more productive uses and better goods from Earth. Figure out those herbs and spices. Figure out how to add value everywhere. I mean, for those of you who have been to the big, vast valley of the Phoenix, Arizona area, does anyone really think that that open desert and cactus of Scottsdale is better than the 5-star hotels and resorts and golf courses that replace them? I mean, it's definitely more inhabitable today, and there's a lot more greenery. There's a value-added proposition. I'm not saying that every development that man's been involved in has added value, but there's a distinct potential to add value to this earth. It's not supposed to just stay only wild, though I love the wildness of the outdoors, and I've ventured far and wide in Alaska, in Colorado, in Montana, in Wyoming, all over in Arizona, and I love the outdoors and the wild. But it's not necessarily true that in every instance God wants it to just remain wild. There is room for man to add value to the earth. So that's a quick snippet of some of the elements connected to the reality that you were created to create and to add value. Now, let's just look at a quick word on freedom economics and see if we can pull it all together. So in order to create, you've got to be free to create, because part of creating is to come up with the thing you're going to create and add value to. It can't just be controlled. So how does economic freedom work in real life? I mean, does it actually improve the lives of many, or is it just for those few people at the very top that figure it out? So let me give you some facts. In 1800, there were 1 billion people on the earth, and there was this brand new introduction of two things that changed the world forever. Number one, intellectual property rights were made secure in the West. Inventions and innovations were protected through patent offices. And that was true in Western Europe and in the United States. Other countries borrowed from that as well. So that made inventions and innovation flourish because you could get rewarded for it. Number two was private property rights became widespread. What that did is gave you the opportunity to maximize the value of your asset. You could trade your gold for something else that you thought was going to actually go up in value if you believed so. And it also opened the door for trade across borders. What that does is open you up to the world. You can get spices, you can get turmeric from India, and you can get that a lot less expensively than if you had to go over there on a boat and get it yourself because of the exchange of goods and services across borders. So this produced, that's three, I said there were two, but that third one actually matters as well. So that produced what you know to be the Industrial Revolution. Now, if those things had happened in 1200, the Industrial Revolution would have happened in 1200. You wouldn't have had to wait those 600 extra years. So in 1800, you got a billion people, and the gross world product is $175 billion in constant dollars. So it's basically every person makes about $175 a year. That's in 2017 dollars. So in 1970, there's 4 billion people. The gross world product is $10 trillion. Everybody on the planet makes an average of $2,500 per person per year. In 1900, there's 5 billion people. Gross world product is $25 trillion. Everyone's now doubled it again. You went from, in the very few short period of years, from 1970 to 1990, just 20 years, you doubled the gross world product per person per year. What's happening around the world at this time? Even though there's still the fight against socialism and Marxism, it's been largely defeated in the larger countries. Western Europe, the Soviet Union has crumbled, and Georgia as a country is now able to be free, and they're promulgating that. Poland is doing the same. It's happening all over the world. Even in China, just out of competition, they're allowing more freedom among their people as it relates to economics. They're allowed to have some private property rights. There are some billionaires getting minted over in China. So now we fast forward to 2011. There's 7 billion people. Gross world product, $70 trillion. You're up to $10,000 a person a year. It doubled again. And in 2019, you're up to 7.6 billion people with a gross world product of $87 trillion, $11,400 per person per year. So what's happened to the world economy is that hundreds of millions of people have come out of poverty just in India and China. The world economy, which comprises of 194 economies, in 2020, still at $84 trillion, even after you factor in the $4 trillion hit from COVID. So what does all this mean? Well, things are better in macroeconomic terms, for sure. You live today better than many kings lived in 1700. So what is economics? A social science concerned chiefly with the description and the analysis of production, distribution, and consumption of goods and services. That's what it means. That's the classical definition. It's really the study, though, of man in the ordinary business of life. It inquires how he or she gets his income and how he or she uses it. So it's on the one hand the study of wealth, and on the other hand, and really maybe the more important side, it's the study of how men and women live. So freedom economics really depends on four components. And when one of them falters, it does impair the overall capability to truly create value. You might still be able to get rich in isolated circumstances, but the general population doesn't grow as fast economically without all four components. So the first component of freedom economics is the free market. It's just an economic system where prices are determined by an unrestricted competition between privately owned businesses. The government doesn't get involved in controlling pricing. It's also free enterprise. This is the second component. It's an economic system where private business operates in competition and is largely free of state control. Number three is the concept of capitalism. That's an economic and political system in which a country's trade and industry are controlled by private owners for profit rather than by the state. And then the final concept is an enterprise culture. It's a capitalistic society in which taking on financial risks in the hope of huge profit is actually encouraged by the government. So when one of those four, or two of those four, or three of those four get compromised or restricted, then it does overall restrict the freedoms that are connected to it. And so what are the freedoms connected to economic freedom? Every one of your freedoms are connected to economic freedom. Your political freedom is connected to economic freedom. In fact, I would argue that to the extent that freedom economics has prevailed, even in the midst of countries, including the United States, attempting to control people more, what's ended up happening is the market forces have put a stay on how much government can control folks. So politically, it has an impact. It has an impact socially. It has an impact on your physical being. If you don't have a complete free economic system, you're going to enjoy less goods and services. You're going to be able to do less with them, and you're going to be constrained more. It has an impact on you spiritually. If you don't have the opportunity to freely engage without having levers picked up and down by a government, without aggressive regulators being engaged and trying to control you, if you don't have that freedom, then your creativity is limited. Here's what's interesting. Some of the folks that right now are arguing against your economic freedom had economic freedom to have the power to make that argument. All those big tech guys were completely unregulated. The only regulations benefited them. 230 is this regulation that basically insulates them from being sued for civil action related to the type of industry they're in, which is to open up the spigot for people to speak their mind. So companies like Facebook and Twitter and so forth have these immunities that other companies and industries don't, but they had almost no regulation against them. Because they had no regulation, the sky was the limit. Different competitors could come up and compete with each other. And what ended up happening in some of these instances is those competitors had such great ideas, those bigger companies would gobble them up, buy them, acquire them, and bring them into their organization and utilize those services until they became so huge they are where they are today. But they got there because there was freedom. Total economic freedom. So it's completely hypocritical for some of those huge companies to be speaking to you about being okay with more regulations just because you're in a different industry doesn't make your industry less worthy of you being free to create and develop. So economic freedom is linked to all the other freedoms because you are what you earn and spend. In fact, if you'll give me a chance to look at your checkbook or every way in which you spend money, probably not a checkbook, all of your digital tools, I can tell you a lot about yourself. I can tell you based on how much you give and who you give to, what your thoughts are regarding contributions and what you believe about that. I can tell you based on where you spend your money and how you spend your money a lot about you. And with a little bit of training, you could do the same with me if you don't already have that training. And so what does this mean? What it means is that your essence of what you can bring to the table is connected to what you earn and what you spend. And for someone to interfere with that is a direct violation of your basic fundamental freedom rights to life and to liberty and to the pursuit of happiness. It touches all three of them. So do your part to hold on to freedom. And don't let someone take away your economic freedoms. It's essential for all the others. God bless you. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.
Hi, I'm David Farah. Thank you for listening to my dad's podcast, The Barry Farah Show, Culture Shift. Click subscribe now to be sure you don't miss an episode. Share this podcast with your friends on social media and give The Barry Farah Show your 5-star rating. Check out today's show notes below this episode and at TheBarryFarahShow.com. This podcast is also available in video format at The Barry Farah Show on YouTube. See you next time.